contracting and onboarding process with you and take any questions that you may have regarding these two processes. Yeah. Hello. Okay, so on the agenda today we have contracting, which I will cover. We'll go over some statistics with regards to contracting, eligibility criteria, the overall contracting process, as well as a couple of specific items relating to Exhibit 8 and Code of Conduct. And then Krista will discuss registry onboarding, including the steps of the registry onboarding process, as well as the timeline. Okay. Next slide, please. This is the same slide that we show on the Monday Nucci TOD program update session. These stats are good as of last Friday. We sent out some new contracts yesterday, so these stats do not reflect the new contracts we just sent out yesterday. They're reflective of what happened as of last Friday. I'll just quickly go over them again. There are 960 eligible applications that have been invited to the contracting process. This is through priority 1930. Of that number, we've received 275 responses back, which is about a 28% response rate, so it's still below 30. Of the 275 responses that we received back, 178 registry agreements have been sent to the applicant for signature. And of that number, we've signed 144 registry agreements. The bottom number that you see there is essentially the number of applications that are not yet eligible for contracting, which is 806. The reason that they may not be yet eligible for contracting may be because of a change request, pending change request, GAC advice, because they're in contention, or have a pending objection. So I wanted to quickly remind everyone again of what the eligibility criteria that we are using for both invitation to contracting as well as to sign contracts. This first slide shows the eligibility criteria for CIR invites. So to receive a contracting information request invitation, the application must be an active application, so meaning it's not withdrawn or not approved. It must have passed evaluation. It must not be in contention. It must have no pending objection, or the applicant must have prevailed. Must not have any pending change requests. It must not be in the high-risk category of the name collision report, and it must not be subjected to any GAC advice, including category 1 GAC advice, category 2 if they indicated that they're going to be an exclusive access registry, consensus GAC advice, non-consensus GAC advice, some GAC advice, no consensus GAC advice on safeguards, and GAC advice that requires further consideration. So those are the categories of GAC advice that's preventing an application from being invited to contracting. So with regards to contract signing, the application, in order to sign a contract, the application must meet all of the previous eligibility criteria that I just went over, in addition to these four. So it must not be in the 30-day application comment window for an approved change request. It must not have any further background screening due diligence issues. Must have a compliant COI. And it must not be party to any ongoing ICANN accountability mechanisms. So I'm going to go over the contracting process a bit. This slide shows the contracting process at a high level, and then we'll go down to the details in the next few slides. I've shown this in a different way in the webinar before, but essentially the first step of the contracting process is that we review the CIR response, so any responses that you provide once you receive a CIR. That typically that takes place on Mondays of every week. And I'll go over what that process is in the next few slides. So on Monday, we review CIR responses that have come in for the week. On Tuesday, through the following Wednesday, we perform what's called substantive review of the CIR responses, so a deeper level of review. Once that's completed, then the RA is drafted. Once it's drafted, then it gets sent to the applicant for signature. And then ICANN executes the contract, and then we post it on the ICANN website. So also on this slide, you can see the days that we typically perform these activities and the number of days that each activity takes. So this represents, if you add all of this up, all of the days up, it represents a 3 to 4 week cycle time for the contracting process. So in the next few slides, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about each of the steps that was in the graph on the previous slide. So as I mentioned, the first step in the process is to review the CIR response to make sure that it is complete. This activity takes place on Mondays of every week. What we review for is basically to, if the CIR response indicates, for example, that you would like to request an exemption to the code of conduct, what we're reviewing for at this step is to make sure that there is an attachment provided, meaning there is a request form provided, and that the TOD registration policy is also attached. So it's really reviewing for the completeness of the CIR response. If any follow-up is required at this step, meaning, say, for example, we find that you indicated that you wanted to request an exemption to the code of conduct, but no attachment is provided, then we will perform follow-up. And if follow-up is performed, then the CIR will stays in this queue until that issue is fixed. I wanted to also go through a couple of reminders because these reminders are based on what we see applicants trip up on. So please be mindful that we don't consider a CIR to be submitted, and we don't begin the CIR completeness review process until your CIR form is submitted. It must be submitted. You know, if it's just saved, we don't consider that a complete answer, and therefore we don't start the process. So please make sure you do submit your CIR responses. Also, the attachments that you provide should be consistent with what you indicate on your CIR form, like what I just talked about with the exemption to the code of conduct request. You know, if you indicate that you want to request that, then please make sure there's an attachment provided. And if you're not going to request that, make sure you don't provide any attachment. So the next step in the process is the substantive review process. Essentially, this is a more complete and detailed review of the information that you provide in the CIR response. So, for example, you know, all of the various point of contacts that you provide, we perform a review of those point of contacts against the information provided in the application and make sure that it is consistent. This step also includes the creation of Exhibit A and Specification 12 if one is required for a community application. And then we also gather all of the relevant information for the application in preparation for the drafting of the registry agreement. You know, things such as, you know, a voluntary pick if one was submitted, and the COI. And again, if any follow-up is required at this step, then the CIR will stay in this stage or in this queue until the issue is fixed. So say, for example, you don't have a compliant COI, we will perform follow-up at this stage, and your application will remain in this queue until that issue is fixed. A couple of reminders for this step. You know, please make sure that if you are requesting an exemption to the code of conduct, that your code of conduct exemption request form is complete. We've received several forms that are not completely filled out, and so that can delay the processing of your contract. Also, please make sure that the complete TOD registration policy is included with your request. Additionally, if you are declaring any cross ownership, please make sure that you provide the IANA number or what's also called a GUR ID number on your declaration form. That would speed up the processing of your contract. If that information is not provided, we will reach out to you and ask for that information. So after we gather all of the necessary information, then the next step is the actual creation of the registry agreement. And the registry agreement is created based on the information that's in your application, as well as in your CIR response and and your PIC if one was submitted. Just a couple of reminders here. If you are requesting changes to the terms and conditions of the registry agreement, your requested changes will be reviewed at this time. And if we have any questions or follow-up items, we will reach out to you at this step. And then if your code of conduct exemption, if you requested a code of conduct exemption, that request is also reviewed by legal and the registry services team at this step. And again, if there's just any questions or follow-up required, it will be performed at this step. After we have the RA drafted, then we send it out to the applicant for review and signature. This step takes place on Tuesdays of every week. If you requested an electronic signature, you receive the contract via DocuSign, and you may sign via DocuSign. If a manual signature is requested, the process is that we send you the registry agreement and a supplement through the customer service portal. What you can do is you can then review it, and if you don't have any issues with it, you can print and sign the signature-only pages of the contract, and then that's what you would be sending back to ICANN. It's just the signature pages. You would send back to us however many copies that you want to retain, plus one copy for ICANN. And please also provide a return address when you send us the signature pages of the contract. Once we receive that, then the next step is for us to execute the registry agreement. If you request the electronic signature, ICANN will execute the agreement via DocuSign, and you will get a copy of the executed contract. If a manual signature is requested, ICANN will countersign the signature pages that you sent, and then we will attach to those signature pages the contract and the supplement, and then we'll mail however many copies you've requested back to you. Once all of that is done, we typically try to post the registry agreements on Friday. So execution takes place on Thursdays, and we post the executed registry agreements to the ICANN website on Fridays. If there are more than 20 registry agreements, then we have to split the posting up into to Thursday and Friday. But if it's less than 20, they all will be posted on Fridays. You can see the link where the registry agreements are posted there. Also posted on this page are a few other items like the alternate path to delegation reports, the TOD startup information as well. So with regards to Exhibit A, I know there's been some confusion because the CIR form does ask whether or not you intend to offer non-standard registry services, and if you do, to provide those non-standard registry services. What I want to remind everyone is that Exhibit A is actually drafted based on the information that is in your application and the voluntary PIC if one was submitted. So any non-standard registry services that you would like to offer, you will have to, if they are already specified in either your application or the PIC, they will be in the Exhibit A of the contract. But if they're not, they will not be included in the Exhibit A, and you will need to submit a change request to add those non-standard registry services. Chris, I'm going to ask you.
There's a question. Go ahead.
The question was, could we please give an example of what would be considered a non-standard registry service?
So non-standard registry services are those services that are not required under the contract. An example would be IDN tables is one of them. I'm totally drawing a blank right now. I'll come up with some for you.
Yeah.
While train continues, I'll come up with some more for you.
Like I mentioned, if you like to offer any non-standard registry services that was not specified in your application or the PIG, then you would have to submit a change request to add those services. With regards to code of conduct exemption requests, just a reminder that as per the code of conduct exemption request process that we have posted on the new GTOD microsite, the code of conduct exemption request will be reviewed in parallel to the creation of the registry agreement. So the two are on parallel tracks, and that the registry agreement may be signed before a final determination on the code of conduct exemption request is made. So if you choose, you can go ahead and sign the registry agreement with Spec 9, and then we will separately review your request for the exemption to the code of conduct. And if that request is approved, it will be communicated to you separately, and the final approval will be provided in a written communication, and that will also be posted. If we do approve the code of conduct exemption request, it will not be reflected in Spec 9, meaning no amendments will be made directly to Specification 9 if we do approve a code of conduct exemption request. So that is the end of my section. Krista?
Thanks. So I'm going to talk about registry onboarding, which is... So registry onboarding is basically the process of where your relationship as a registry operator begins with ICANN. It's basically the setting up of your registry, and the interactions that you'll have with ICANN. Up until this point, everything that we know about you is related to your application and not to this contracted party that may be very different than that application phase. So it's really a point where we collect contact information that is applicable to the actual registry itself, as well as facilitating the technical setup for the various interactions that you'll have with ICANN throughout the relationship with us. Registry onboarding starts upon execution of your registry agreement, and we will run it in parallel to PDT, delegation, and Sunrise. So registry onboarding has three main steps. The first step is data collection, and that's where we have two different parts to the data collection step. The first part is where we ask you to provide onboarding contact information, and we also facilitate the issuance of your trademark database or TMDB token. The second part of data collection is where we ask you to provide information related to credentialing and to facilitate operational support mechanisms for the registry. The second step is a technical setup, and that's really an ICANN step, and that's where we establish and test service functionalities. And finally, the third step is where you establish your Sunrise claims and limited registration, if you have one, periods. So step 1A, or the first part of step 1, is where we collect your registry operator contacts. So currently this step, I'll talk through the contacts first, actually. So we collect a primary contact for the registry. So you are all really familiar with your primary contact for your application. However, that may not be the same person for the actual registry once it's established. So we collect your primary registry contact. We already actually have your legal notices point of contact because you provided that during contracting. So that actually is pre-populated for you based on what you provided in your CIR response and what is noted in your registry agreement. We ask if you do have a back-end technical service provider that you give us a contact for them. We ask for your data escrow contact. We ask for a technical point of contact. If you want to provide a media and communications contact, you can. We ask for a billing contact. a 24/7 emergency point of contact. We do ask for at least two emergency points of contact in case there is an emergency and we can't reach the first person. We ask for a centralized zone data system point of contact, or CZDS. We ask for an abuse contact, which is the required abuse contact that's stated in the registry agreement. We ask for a compliance point of contact, a URS point of contact, and finally a trademark database point of contact. The trademark database point of contact, this is described in the TMDB process documentation that's posted on the microsite. However, as a reminder, that TMDB point of contact that you provide is the person that will interface with IBM to exchange tokens, so you want to be cognizant of that. Once we receive the TMDB point of contact, we will provide you with your TMBD token, because there's a parallel process that you have with IBM where you need to perform integration testing to get certified with the TMDB. The contact registry operator contact information, as I said earlier, as soon as you sign your registry agreement, shortly thereafter, you'll receive, currently the way the process works is you'll receive an email from us with an Excel spreadsheet asking to populate these details. We're currently developing the customer portal so that you would be able to enter that stuff. In the future, you would instead receive a note from the customer portal asking you to log in and start entering all of this data that way. So some of you who have gone early will see that process change and get a little bit less cumbersome. So the question is on legal point of contact, if it has anything to do with jurisdiction. No, your legal notice is point of contact. Any contract always says who do we send legal notices to, and that's you actually do provide that during contracting. It's actually in the registry agreement. You can see that person, and it doesn't have to do with jurisdiction. Step 1B. We've called it the onboarding information request, and we didn't want it to feel lonely and not have its own acronym, so it's an it's a really nice acronym, ONBIR. We actually kind of joke about this a little bit, but anyway, the ONBIR is a form that this is where we collect credentialing and operational system setup information. It is you will receive it from the customer portal. It is what the technical people tell me, they call a flat file, but in real words, it's a .txt file or a .txt file. And the reason we ask you to fill it out in this format is because we can automatically ingest it into our systems, and it facilitates, it enables us to process the information much more quickly. So what you get is a notification from the customer portal with the attachment asking you to complete it. It asks for several pieces of data. It asks for your zone file access for the CZDS, the eBureau, and for ICANN. We ask with CZDS, there are a couple of paths you can take there. Depending on which path you choose, we ask for different information, and this is all explained in the form itself. We also ask for the URI for your bulk thin registration data access. We ask for the IP addresses and passwords for the registry reporting interface, which is where you'll submit your reports to ICANN every month. We ask for a, related to the uniform rapid suspension, we ask for a PGP key and a password. If you have EPP extensions, we also ask that you attach them with your response to the ONBIR. There is specific instructions about how those EPP extensions must be documented, and you need to provide a separate document for each EPP extension. And we also describe the file naming convention for EPP extensions. So we ask that when you're creating your EPP extension documentation, that you please follow the file naming convention that we've described in the OMBIR. We ask you to provide IDN tables, and then we ask for the servers the username and password for EPP SLA monitoring. So it's important, a couple of important points about step 1A and 1B. They're both required in order for you to transition to IANA, which for you means in order for you to get your delegation token. So you have quite a bit of time. I have a timeline at the end to represent the amount of time that you have to do that. However, it's just important to realize that if this is not completed, it is a gating factor to getting your delegation token. The other thing I wanted to point out is, like almost everything we do at ICANN, there's always one caveat, or at least one. The IDN tables are the one thing that's not required at this time, and actually the requirement is that you provide those upon delegation. The IANA team doesn't have a place to put those tables until the TLD is delegated. So everything except the IDN tables is required prior to getting your delegation token. So step two, as I said earlier, this is actually an ICANN step, but you'll see some of this going on, or at least your technical, for those of you that are technical, and those of you that aren't, the technical team at your company will see this going on. Step two is where we establish and test the service capabilities. So we set up the zone file access for CZDS, ICANN, and Ebro consumption. And if you are hosting your own zone files, ICANN will create the alias CNAME records for these servers. We establish the bulk thin registration data access, and we provide access to the registry reporting interface. Additionally, we also provide access to the registry to download the URS provider keys, which you'll need to perform the URS processes, and we collect your PGP key. We also collect EPP extensions. We already have them, but review them and associate them with, if they need to be associated with the setup of your registry. We set up the EPP SLA monitoring and the EPP system access data, and then again, you would be providing your IDN tables at this time. So step three is where you establish your Sunrise claims limited registration periods if you have a limited registration period. This step can be performed at any time. It's really up to the registry. It's not required at a specific time. And I know that there's been several sessions this week where we've talked a lot about the setup, Sunrise periods. There was a specific RPM session where we talked about this, but we wanted to just review it again here for you because it is really part of setting up your registry. The TLD startup information is a defined term in the Trademark Clearinghouse Rights Protection Mechanism Requirements document. Currently, we have a Sunrise portal that's being developed. We'll see the first iteration of that in mid-December, and then a more robust version of it will be launched in the target dates are mid-December for the first iteration, and the more robust second iteration we expect in mid-January. So currently it's a form that's posted on the microsite that you submit through the customer service center. However, once the portal is up, you would be able to just log in and enter your TLD startup information, attach the required documents, et cetera, through the portal. So the information that is required with your TLD that we call your TLD startup information, also defined in the RPM requirements document. We need to know what type of Sunrise you're going to run. Is it a start date Sunrise or an end date Sunrise? We need to know the dates that you would like to have your sunrise period. We ask for, I think we give you two, you can ask for two or three preferred dates that you'd like to start your sunrise, and there's also an option to select first available. The form itself explains how those interact, because if for some reason you weren't able to get the first or second date, you could still select first available as your third option. We need you to attach your complete sunrise policies for the registry. We ask that you please attach a document and don't provide links to those documents, because we need to be able to post them and associate them with your registry. Part of the sunrise policies, you have to include your SDRP, or your sunrise dispute resolution procedure. We also ask for the dates of your claims periods, and then certification that integration testing has been completed. So all of these items are required in the TLD startup info. Additional information is, if you are running a limited registration period, it's optional in that if you're not running one, you don't have to provide it. If you are running one, you do have to provide it. We would need the dates of your limited registration period. As I said earlier, you submit the information using the form that's posted through the customer service portal. So you can do that by logging in or by emailing newgtld@icann.org. So once you've been delegated, the first point that you can submit your TLD startup information is following delegation, so or upon delegation, or any time after that. You cannot submit TLD startup information prior to delegation. The registry submits its information to ICANN, including the requested dates. And then what ICANN does is we do a straightforward review of what you've submitted to make sure that the dates are in compliance with the requirements of the RPMs document, and that you've attached and provided all of the required elements, including certification from IBM with the trademark database. Once we receive your TLD startup information, we review it, and then we'll schedule the dates with IBM. So at one point, I think we contemplated, and some of you may have experienced this, having you schedule dates directly with IBM. We tried to take that step out and make it easier rather than have sort of back and forth between IBM and us. You give us the dates, we get it scheduled, and then we communicate back to you what the scheduled dates are. And if there's any issues with this information that you submitted, then we'll be back in touch with you to ask you know, for clarification or corrections. So here's the timeline. I'm trying to depict here to give you guys a sense of where onboarding, because it parallels processes, and so to give you a sense of the timing that you have to complete onboarding and where the different steps occur as you're, you know, going through PDT and delegation. So you've got contracting completes, that's the top blue line, your registry agreement signed, and then you have approximately 6 weeks of pre-delegation testing. If you look at the first orangish line, that's where registry onboarding begins and where steps 1A and 1B, or the data collection steps, must be completed. You have about a two-week period after PDT where you're transitioning to actual delegation. And as I said, you still have some time in there to complete your step one of onboarding, but you do have to complete that in order to get your delegation token. Once you're delegated, registry onboarding step two happens, which is really, again, the ICANN process where we do the technical implementation. And then finally, registry onboarding step three is actually not correctly depicted, so we'll update the slide. That can actually begin upon delegation as well. You can start that that process of submitting your TLD startup information. So that would actually line up right underneath the step two. And I think Oh, one more thing. So what we ask you to do is once you've signed your registry agreement, please be on the lookout for the email request for the contact information, and then the email from the customer portal asking you to go in and download and fill out your onboarding information request. And then any questions, of course, can always be submitted to newgtld@icann.org. And finally, just a reminder that we still have a few Global Domains Division sessions left this week. There is a provider session with the Trademark Clearinghouse, so it's really it's IBM and Deloitte talking to you about their own processes and how you interact with them directly. There is the IDN Variant TLDs program later today as well, and then there is a continued operations for new GTLD session that occurs tomorrow morning. So with that, I will open it up for questions.
Reg Levy, I have a question about IDNs and the IDN lists. Sorry, Reg Levy. I have a question about IDNs and IDN lists. The request for them as an approved registry services in the CIR phase, is ICANN approving them? Have they, once we receive the contract, can we assume that our tables are in some way approved? Are you going through them and checking, making sure that they're valid, or is it really just you're approving the fact that we have them?
We're just approving the fact that you have them. As you know, pre-deduction testing is when the IDN tables are looked at.
I just want to add one more thing. With respect to the actual agreement and the languages, those are taken strictly from your application. So we've had some instances where there's the languages that you have in your application are not necessarily the languages you want to provide in your registry, or there should be more, or there's some sort of, you know, typographical error. We go strictly with what's in the application, and then you would you have two options. You can submit a change request, or you can wait until you execute your agreement and then submit a registry serve an RCEP requesting the additional languages. So there's two parts to that, but the tables.
Okay, that's helpful, and it kind of actually makes the reason that we're providing IDN tables at CIR even more confusing. If you're going from our application, why are we providing tables?
I don't think the CIR form itself asks for IDN tables. There is a question that asks whether or not you are intending to offer any non-standard registry services, but I don't think we're specifically asking for IDN tables to be submitted with the CIR response.
Fair enough. The final question says, if there are any yes answers above, please provide attachments.
Yes. If you answer yes, then provide an attachment.
Which would be the IDN tables.
Or it can be a description of what the non-standard services you would like to provide in the languages.
Okay. So then my other question is, do we need to... Are you providing the IDN tables that we provided at CIR to IANA?
Okay. No, so just the IDN tables are not required in the CIR, so we would not provide those to IANA. The second, the second piece is, again, the IDN tables are required upon delegation. You have to provide those to IANA upon delegation?
Right.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Hello, Andrew Merriam. Thank you both. Can we go to your timeline slide, that last timeline slide, please? Yeah, that one. The last little bar doesn't have any dates on it. Is that? I think you just covered an end tag, and you said it was a week, Krista?
Oh, yeah. So just a reminder, that bar is in the wrong spot. It really needs to run parallel to the bar above it.
Oh, okay.
So you can start it upon delegation. And we'll correct the slide before we post it. The second piece is thank you for bringing this up, actually. It's a great question. It doesn't have dates because you can submit the information anytime you want. But to your point, we ask that you give us a 7-day window to process the TLD startup information. We don't anticipate that it will always take that long, but it'd be nice to have, it's just good to have the cushion in there. And again, you can select first available as an option. Okay. So if we process it in 2 days or 3 days or whatever, you would have the ability to start sooner. So I'll give an example. So if you submit it on the 1st of January, we ask that you give us your first requested date would be January 8th. However, you can also just select first available, and if it's processed and completed and back to you on January 3rd, then we would give you the date, that date.
Okay. And I believe prior guidance to ICANN kind of had like time frames like 6 to 8 weeks, things like that. Is this kind of the new, these are all very firm looking, is this the new?
These are the same as all ICANN timelines. Okay. This is, you know, if you guys are responding quickly and there aren't issues, and you know what I mean, if there's nothing special about it, the estimated time that it would take. So it can be less, it can also be more, depending on the specific registry's circumstances.
And just an administrative point, these slides already are posted, just so you know.
Okay, so we'll update the posting. Thank you.
Werner Stahl from CORE. Two little questions. One of them is for the EPP extensions that we submit. Are these going to be published by ICANN somewhere, you know, for the benefit of the technical community, so they could actually see what kind of diverse things are around there?
No, we do not publish them.
Okay. And the corollary is, you know, if there may be a need to change those, actually a good reason to change them specifically, because in the context of launch periods, there is a great diversity of different ways of doing it, and the standardization effort, of course, you know, has tried to keep up with it, but some of these things are coming out, so sometimes it might be a good idea for a registry to use the standard instead of, you know, whatever has been defined 2 years ago. Is it then not allowed to make the change?
No, that you are absolutely allowed to make the change. Okay. I'm actually glad you asked this question too, because it's a really important point. If you do update your tables, you do need to submit the updated table to us, and you can do that through the customer portal.
So the same thing would apply for IDN tables and for extensions? You said tables, that's why I'm asking.
Yes.
Okay. And the other one is actually, is not. We're going to announce dates for the sunrises. And remember that, you know, there was thing like if you change the dates, you have to allow ICANN to, you know, to inform ICANN at least 4 days or something ahead. Now there is one case where actually that might make no sense, and that is if as a result of a last minute onslaught in the sunrise, things that we've seen in the past, the right thing to do is to extend the sunrise. It's not like, you know, we just, you know, take advantage of the situation. There has been last-minute onslaught. The only orderly way of handling things would be, in such a case, to extend the sunrise. So is that something that could somehow be put into the terms that it would be allowed?
I actually don't really know the answer to that question. I know that the document does have a requirement in it, the RPM requirements document does. What I will do is we can certainly take that back, I wasn't actually involved in the RPM document discussion, so I don't even know if this has been discussed before or what, but I'm happy to look into it and get back to you.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Hello, I'm Irina Danili, .dt IDN application. Few short questions. With regard the point of contacts, are there any specific requirements or limitation on what is point of contact? Is it like personal address and name and phone number, or it can be group address of duty shift, for example?
Thank you. You mean in the onboarding information?
Yeah.
For onboarding?
Yeah. When you are asked to provide registry operator contacts.
Yes, so thanks for the question, Irina. There are some specific requirements. Everything on there we do require you to provide a contact for, except media and communications. That one's optional. In the requests that we send you, we try to give you a few examples, and in places where we require a real person, so there are a few spots where we require a real person, like emergency contacts. contact, for instance, we spell that out for you as well. So when you receive the request, you'll know what the requirements are. And certainly if you have questions or it's not clear, you know, feel free to just ask.
Thank you. And the second question is with regard to the Sunrise documentation which we are to provide. Can it be provided in the original language of the documents, which for IDN is not necessarily English?
That's a really good question. Let me get back. Let me check into that and get back to you. I'll get you an answer. Thank you for the question.
And the third question is with regard to claims period dates. Like having long sunrise and then probably limited registration periods, the registry might need like few months to go through all these periods. And this, at the moment of onboarding request, may not be quite sure on the exact date of general registration. So can we have like kind of flexibility with defining these periods, claim periods?
So a couple things. You establishing, you know, submitting the Sunrise information or the TLD startup information, you can start that as early as right after delegation, but you can start it later as well. So that's one thing. The second point is you do have to provide your registration policies, and those need to describe the time period. So you would need to have that locked down. But again, if you don't have it at delegation and you maybe have it 2 weeks later or 30 days or 90, you know, whatever it is, you would then at that point submit your TLD startup information and have the complete information in there.
So I have to provide exact date of general registration, yeah? Because the claims periods are dependent on that date, yeah?
You have to provide the length of time, so for the periods that precede general availability. So, no, you don't have to. I don't believe you have to provide the date for general availability. Mm-hmm. We're looking for the timelines, you know. So you have a requirement to run claims for so long and to run Sunrise for so long. Some people may do it for longer, mm-hmm. for shorter. We're asking for the dates that you intend to run those periods, mm-hmm. and then would expect that your registration policies would detail that the timeline or the length of time, and then in your registration policy you would talk about when general availability occurs. So for example, you know, you might say that you have a 90-day sunrise and a 90-day claims period, and then you'll have a 30-day quiet period, and then general availability begins. As one example.
Because if you use, for example, auctions during one of the periods, the registry cannot be sure how long it will actually take. Yeah? It's like always unpredictable time frame. Okay, thank you.
Hello, Ray Fassett, existing contracted party with ICANN on the registry side and applicant for new ones. A little bit of a step back reality check, okay? The final registry agreement was not published until well after applications were submitted, and business plans were, of course, included in the, you know, say, the financial evaluation aspect.
Closer to the mic.
Thank you. Mike, you know, as any contract now, the final contract, it has provisions in this contract. And provisions in the contract can have different interpretations. What is the process an applicant, what resources is ICANN providing applicants to simply discuss interpretations of provisions of the registry agreement without having to check the box that we want to enter into contract negotiations? Applicants need some help to understand their interpretation of provisions as it may relate to their specific business models for launching the TLD, because not all business models are the same. And since the registry agreement was not finalized until after the applications were submitted, and there are provisions in this registry agreement that could be subject to different interpretation, how is ICANN assisting the applicants to simply discuss the interpretations to make sure that we're interpreting the same?
Thanks for the question, Ray. I'd like to speak to you offline a little bit more, but in general, this is a legal document. A registry agreement is a legal document, and as with any legal document, it's subject to interpretations, like you said. And I don't know that ICANN is in a position to provide any legal advice to any applicants, but what you're asking, just in terms of clarification of certain provisions and things like that, we have had those questions. We've received those questions through the customer service portal. And we do try to provide clarification to the extent that we can without providing legal advice. Certainly happy to speak with you afterwards on this more.
Thank you very much.
Couple of questions from the remote participants. I don't know if this first one has already been covered before with the previous question, but I'll read it anyway because it came in before the other question. In the chat room, and it's from Christopher Nimi. If IDN tables were provided in the answer to question 44 of the application, would an applicant need to check the box on number 2, Exhibit A, approved services in the CIR, and provide the 44 information again?
No. So if the IDN tables were already provided in the applications and there are no changes to that information, you do not need to check that box or provide the updated information. Because the Exhibit A is going to be created based on what's in your application. Now, if that information has changed, then yes, we would need you to submit a change request to add the information.
If I can just add one clarification. Trang said it, but just for those of you who maybe haven't gotten contracts, ICANN is drafting Exhibit A, proactively drafting your Exhibit A's based on the information you provided in your application. So if there are other non-standard services like IDNs, that information would be captured from the application, pre-populated in an Exhibit A for you. When you're checking the box in the CIR, it's just really an opportunity for you to say, hey, we know we have these non-standard services, ICANN, please be cognizant of them. If we receive something that does not map to what we found in your application, we would go back and make sure we didn't miss anything, and then we would enter into a dialogue with you on that.
And just to add to that, I know that has caused some confusions. So I'm actually, one of the things I'm working on is to revise that CIR form to make it a lot more clear. So I'm hoping, I'm trying to push to get that rolled out as soon as possible, significantly simplifying the form and automating that quite a bit so that, to make it a lot more clear. So that's coming.
Thank you. The second question from the remote participant, Steiner Grotrod, sorry if I got your name wrong, at Krista. Question, if possible, could you give an overview of the URLs to the systems for all the POCs?
Sorry, can you say it one more time?
Yes. If possible, could you give an overview of the URLs to the systems for all the POCs? Points of contact.
Yeah, no, I know.
I'm not sure what URLs.
I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I don't understand the question. Maybe they could rephrase it and try again.
Sure. If you could put the question in the chat again, a little more clearer, I'll re-ask it.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Krista Rubinsky, Nick.br. I wonder what's current like ICANN thinking on RCEPs for liberation of two-character codes that aren't country codes, like two digits or a letter and a digit. Because current version of the registry agreement, unlike the applicant guidebook, specifies that all two-character domains are blocked. Not only two-letter domains are blocked. So there are a lot of domains that aren't possible ISO codes that are blocked and would need an RCEP to be cleared out. So I would like to know if you have considered this issue before.
So with respect to the RCEP, we evaluate them when we receive them. So it's, again, like most things that ICANN does, we ask for that to be submitted in writing, and then we would, look at the specific information that's provided and consider that in our evaluation. So it's difficult to say what we would say or do without actually seeing what the request is.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rubens.
Hi, Krista. So I have a couple of questions. So looking at that, let me speak up. Sorry, looking at that timeline up there. So I just want to ask if the steps that you've described there are on the critical path to some of the milestones. So step 1A and B, can I assume that a registry operator won't receive the delegation token until that information is provided? Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then you've got step 2. Can I assume that a registry operator won't be able to provide its TLD startup information until those tests are complete?
That is incorrect. The slide's incorrect. So we're going to update it. So it actually, step 2 and 3 should run parallel to one another. You can, and again, just to reiterate, you can submit your TLD startup information as soon as you've been delegated, but you can do it later than that as well. It's just the first opportunity for you to submit it is once you've been delegated.
Okay, but I don't have to, those tests in registry onboarding 2 don't need to be done before the, when do they need to be done by?
So that's correct. They don't need to be done before you submit TLD startup information.
Do they need to be done before sunrise?
Say that again?
Do they need to be done before sunrise?
Step 2, does it need to be done before sunrise?
Does it need to be done before sunrise?
No. They can happen in parallel.
Okay.
And step 2, we say 30 days. It really depends on your delegation date, but we need to get you set up in time to submit your first registry report. So we have about a 30-day window there because reports are due on the 20th of the month.
Okay, great. Now, with respect to IDN tables, that's... So we obviously have to provide those to IANA for publication. If those change, if we update them with IANA, do we still have to send them to ICANN?
If your IDN tables change, then you would need to submit the updated tables to IANA. That's correct.
And not ICANN again. And not ICANN.
No, they go to IANA.
Okay, cool. I had a couple of questions on the code of conduct exemption request, and that's probably directed to you, Trang. Thanks, Krista. So if I'm a registry operator that wants an exemption and I don't have my registration policies just yet, can I tick the box in the CIR? And if so, what do I provide? So I guess the question is, what were registry operators doing before the code of conduct exemption request was finalized?
Just to make sure I understand your question, are you asking what if you would like to request a code of an exemption to the code of conduct, but your TOD registration policy is not yet finalized?
Yeah, so you've got the CIR, and then you've got the actual process that you need to go through to submit the... How do those marry up? Can I just tick the box in the CIR and go through that process later on?
Yes, absolutely. You could request an exemption to the code of conduct at the time that you submit your CIR form, mm-hmm. or after you've signed a registry agreement. Either is fine. If you request it as you submit your CIR response and you do provide all of the relevant information, like the TOD startup information, the request would just sit there until we have the complete information. The registry agreement is being drafted in parallel to that process, so you will still receive a registry agreement, and you can decide at that point whether mm-hmm. or not you want to go ahead and sign the registry agreement mm-hmm. before ICANN completes the review of the request for the code of conduct exemption, mm-hmm. or you may wish to wait until that is done, review of the exemption to the code of conduct is done before you sign the registry agreement. It's entirely up to,
okay.
to you.
Because there's if you tick the box, you need to provide a statement. So can I just provide a one-line statement that says that I intend
yes,
on doing so?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can absolutely submit the CIR response mm-hmm. without the complete information. What I was just reminding you is that if the information is not complete, then the the process will get stuck at that stage, except for things that are happening in parallel, such as a code of conduct exemption request. Obviously, we won't hold you up if you don't provide complete information with your code of conduct exemption request. We'll still move you forward and have the registry agreement drafted. But in the meantime, that code of conduct exemption request review process is going to be halted until we have all of the complete information. Does that make sense?
Yep, that makes sense. And I just had a final suggestion. I think someone brought up the, maybe it was a remote, I don't know, someone brought up the questions through the CSC. So it would really help if you provided a knowledge base like you guys used to during the application period with all the questions that are submitted to the CSC and the subsequent responses, because I know that speaking to other people, we'd submit a question and would get the same response as someone else.
Yes, actually, that's something that I've been trying to work on. Was a way to during the application window. Obviously, the knowledge base was created for applicants. We get questions, we post the answers there, and I've been trying to get that going again for everything. So, yes, working on it.
Great, thank you,
Yasmin, and it's Krista again. If I can just make one clarification. Mm-hmm. So, with respect to the code of conduct, back to that one. If you sign the application and you do not have an exemption to the code of conduct, and the exemption, to be clear, will be something, you'll receive something from ICANN that's, you know, a formal notification that you have been approved to be exempt from the code of conduct. Mm-hmm. So if you sign the registry agreement without having an exemption, you are bound by the code of conduct and until any point that you might receive the exemption. So just because you want to submit a code of conduct exemption request doesn't make you exempt from it. So you, if you're moving forward with signing, you would be obligated to exactly what's in the registry agreement, which is the code of conduct, until such a point that ICANN provided you with an exemption.
Is there a certain point in time after which it would be very difficult for you guys to grant a exemption? Would that be after delegation, or can I run it for?
It's really an operational thing for you guys, frankly. Okay. You know, like how you're running your registry and the application of that exemption. So it's for us, it's any time. You could submit the request any time from when you receive an invitation to contracting, a CIR, into eternity.
So I can be operational for a couple of years and then submit a request there? Right?
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks.
Hello. Serena Danelia, .dtidn application again. The very last chat question. In this onboarding process, probably I have missed, but should at some step we agree and get approval from ICANN for data escrow provider, which we have chosen?
Data escrow, that interaction actually occurs during the pre-delegation testing period.
So it's a part of pre-delegation.
That's correct.
And should we first get approval and then have the data escrow agreement signed?
That has to. Both of those things have to occur during PDT, and they're part of passing PDT is contingent upon those things happening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Irina. That information is also posted on the microsite. The process and all of the information about it.
Great. John McCabe, Husu Registry. Would a non-standard registry service be domains at the third level?
It's a technical question. Unfortunately, I'm not able to answer that, but if you would want to submit that through the customer portal, we can respond to you in writing.
I just don't really understand what the question is asking, because there doesn't appear to be an answer.
Yeah, so as I said earlier, IDNs are the best example of a non-standard. It's because they're not required. You can even have a IDN TLD, and there's no requirement to have second-level IDNs. One would think that you would be providing them, but so if you're going to provide second-level IDNs, it's a non-required service. However, you are going to provide it, so it must be detailed in your registry agreement. So there are services that the registry is going to provide, that only the registry can provide, that are not required under the terms of the registry agreement.
And if that's written in your application?
And yeah, so the follow-up question is, if it's already in your application, you do not need to detail that in your CIR response. And the answer to that question is yes, that's correct. We will find it in your application. The one thing I would say to you, and we've seen this quite a bit, Trang, and is that we're not perfect. Once in a while, we miss something. So we ask that you, first of all, when we send you your registry agreement, I would think you would want to, and I'm sure your counsel would want you to, review it carefully and make sure it's what you expect. Most importantly, that Exhibit A is the one thing that is different, can be different across all registries, so I would review it carefully, and if you think that there's something that should be there that isn't, or vice versa, please let us know, and we can engage in a dialogue on that. Thank you. Wendy, are there any more questions in the queue, in the chat? Any other questions?
So I just have one last comment that, or some news to share, I guess, depending how you want to look at it. Just to say that we're looking into enhancing Salesforce to facilitate the transition from an applicant to registry operator. Obviously, a lot of you have up to until this point being an applicant with certain privileges and access to the portal, and now, you know, that privileges is not being transferred as you roll into being a registry operator. So we're looking at automating Salesforce to facilitate that transition. And then hopefully moving forward in the near future, you as registry operators will have access into Salesforce as well. All right, any questions in the Adobe room? Wendy? Okay. Well, then we'll go ahead and wrap the session. Thank you very much.
What? Oh, you guys.
Sorry, yes, there's one more question from the remote participation. Vivian Coyen, can you please clarify per data escrow agreement section 17.5, is an agreement between registry operator, escrow agent, and bureau, B-E-R-O, a requirement?
I'm sorry, say it one more time.
So is the per data escrow agreement section 17.5, is an agreement between the registry operator, the escrow agent, and the Ebro, or just as Bureau, B-E-R-O, a requirement? She's typing more.
Sorry, I don't know why I'm telling Krista the answer. data escrow agreement is actually between the data escrow provider and the applicant, with ICANN being the beneficiary. Does not mention the Ebro provider. It doesn't pertain to the Ebro provider.
Okay, I think now that's it. Thank you, everybody.